This episode will cover the thorax and lungs assessment following Chapter 19 of the Jarvis textbook. Let's start with a quick review of the relevant anatomy and physiology. The thorax is mainly surrounded by the ribs. All ribs are connected to the vertebral column, which runs midline along the back, and most of them are also connected to the sternum, which runs midline on the chest. On the top of the sternum, there's a notch called the suprasternal notch. A few centimeters below that notch, there's a bony ridge called the sternal angle. At the bottom of the sternum is the costal angle, created by the ribs attached to the bottom of the sternum. On the back, the angle created where the lowest ribs attached to the bottom of the vertebral column is called the costovertebral angle. The inside of this cage of bone is the thoracic cavity, which contains the lungs and the heart. At the bottom of the thoracic cavity is a large muscle called the diaphragm. During inspiration, the diaphragm pulls down, creating negative pressure inside the thoracic cavity, which pulls air into the airways of the lungs. The airway begins at the mouth, then continues down into the larynx, which is also called the voice box, then down the neck through the trachea. The trachea splits into two bronchi, one for each side, and then those bronchi further branch out into consecutively smaller airways until eventually ending up at alveoli, which are the small sacs where gas exchange happens. There are five lung lobes, three on the right, called the right upper, right middle, and right lower lobes, and two on the left, called the left upper lobe and the left lower lobe. If you look at illustrations which show these lobes from the front and back, you will notice that the lobes are not stacked neatly on top of one another like layers on a cake. This is why it is important during the physical assessment to assess all around the thorax to make sure that each lobe is assessed. The lungs are surrounded by a thin lining called the pleurae, which provide lubrication. Before I move on to subjective data, I want to point out a useful landmark in the back of the neck that you can find by flexing your neck so that you are looking down and feeling the back of your neck. The bony prominence you feel there is called the vertebra prominence. The textbook also describes several different reference lines, which do not have any physiological significance, but are effective ways of describing locations within the thorax. The two most commonly used reference lines are the midclavicular line and the midaxillary line. The midclavicular line goes up and down the chest, intersecting the middle of the clavicle, roughly halfway between the midline and the patient's side. The midaxillary line goes up and down the patient's side through the axilla, dividing the front and back half of the body through the armpit. In my experience, the other reference lines are less commonly used, so I will not discuss them here. Subjective data. As always, you will want to ask about personal or family history of lung problems and ask about any relevant risk factors such as smoking or environmental exposure to pollutants. You should ask the client if he or she has a cough, and if so, ask for a description of the cough. In addition to the general questions, you should ask about practically any symptom, such as when it started, what provokes it, what helps it, how severe it is. You should also ask the client to describe how it sounds and also to describe what the sputum looks like. Ask the client if he or she has been experiencing dyspnea, which is a fancy word for shortness of breath, and if so, to describe it. Again, we want to ask the usual questions about timing, severity, provoking, palliating factors, but a specific question that may be particularly enlightening for someone with a chronic lung problem is how the dyspnea has affected daily life. If the patient is experiencing chest pain, make sure to specifically ask if the chest pain is worse with breathing or coughing. Because chest pain and dyspnea are both symptoms of both heart and lung problems, be careful not to make assumptions. Imagine that you are assessing a woman who has a diagnosis of a chronic lung disease. While reviewing her chart before seeing her, you read that this patient has a history of frequent exacerbations of her lung disease, and that these exacerbations have caused chest pain and dyspnea. You meet her, and she tells you that she's experiencing chest pain and dyspnea. You can imagine how incredibly tempting it would be to jump to the conclusion that this is just another exacerbation instead of seriously considering that this patient may be experiencing a heart attack. This kind of mistake can only be avoided with deliberate vigilance. At the time of this recording, it has been about 2 years since the start of the COVID-19 pandemic, so I can probably safely assume that you have heard many of these subjective data questions countless times. Are you experiencing a cough or shortness of breath? or have you recently tested positive for COVID-19? Have you been exposed to anyone with COVID-19? Have you been vaccinated against COVID-19? These kinds of questions are important not only for COVID-19, but also for other respiratory infections as well, such as the flu. Objective data, assessing the posterior chest. Before you even get to the point of assessing the thorax specifically, you will have already performed a general survey, making a quick assessment of the overall skin color and level of consciousness, note the patient's position and overall body language. Now, most of you will be able to recognize most clients in respiratory distress. Simply imagine what a group of runners would look like after an exhausting race. The exhausted facial expressions, the deep, rapid, and forceful breathing, propping up their torso by placing their hands on their knees. This is all normal behavior after an exhausting race, but not in someone just sitting on an examination table at a clinic. But some types of respiratory problems look almost like the opposite of this description. For example, one side effect of opiates is that they depress breathing. So clients having an opiate overdose, even though their body needs more oxygen, will not look like they are struggling to breathe. Their body needs oxygen, but the part of their brain that controls breathing doesn't know that. Many nursing students have never seen someone with this type of respiratory problem, so when they read in a test question or a patient's chart that a patient has, quote, decreased respiratory effort or, quote, shallow breathing, those can almost sound like good things because it means the patient is not working hard to breathe. Be careful not to make this mistake. Inspect the overall shape of the thorax. Look at the patient face to face and note how wide the thorax is. This is called the transverse diameter. Move to the patient's side and see how thick the thorax is from front to back. This is called the anteroposterior diameter. The anteroposterior diameter is normally smaller than the transverse diameter by a ratio of about 0.7 to 1. Next, assess the skin and muscles over the thorax. Look for symmetry, including looking for symmetrical chest rise and fall with breathing. Once you are done inspecting, begin palpating the thorax. Following the book, we will start at the client's back. Place your hands on the client's back and then use your thumbs to pinch a small fold of skin in the middle of the back near the base of the lungs. Ask the client to take in a deep breath and then see if this affects the fold of skin symmetrically. This may seem redundant since you just inspected for symmetrical chest rise, but this technique is more sensitive to smaller changes. Next, palpate for tactile fremitus. Fremitus is a vibration that you can feel. To do this, place your hands against the thorax and ask the client to say either 99 or blue moon. These phrases will create strong vibrations inside the chest, which you can then pick up with your hands. You might think that the fingertips would be the best part of the hand for this task, but actually it's better to use the top of the palm at the base of your fingers. This is because your goal is to try to pick up the vibrations and transmit them into your body, and bone is the best vibration conductor in your body, so you want to put the boniest part of your hand up against the source of vibrations. The book says that abnormal findings include increased fremitus and decreased fremitus, but there isn't really a way to objectively measure fremitus, so for those of you listening to this episode who have never done this before, you will find it difficult to confidently state whether a person you are assessing has decreased, normal, or increased fremitus. There are two principles of assessment which will help to overcome this problem. I will first apply these principles to fremitus, but they will also apply to percussion and auscultation as well. Principle number one, assess as many people as possible. This is true whether these people have normal or abnormal lungs. It isn't enough to only assess one person's normal lungs because there is a wide range of normal, especially based on the thickness of the chest wall. Principle number two, after assessing a location on one side, immediately assess the same location on the other side. This will help you identify asymmetry. See figure 19.15 for an illustration of this second principle in action. Notice that immediately after assessing fremitus in one location of the thorax, the pattern prompts you to immediately move your hand to the corresponding location on the other side of the thorax to compare. Notice that you won't need to know what a normal or abnormal fremitus feels like in order to notice asymmetry. If the fremitus on a patient's right side is greater than the fremitus on a patient's left side, then you know that there is either a problem on the right side causing increased fremitus or a problem on the left side causing decreased fremitus. Next, percuss the back of the thorax, starting from high on the back and moving down to the base of the lungs. The normal finding as you percuss over the lungs is a hollow, low-pitched sound described as resonance. If there is too much air being pushed out into the lungs over a long period of time, the lungs will become abnormally large, causing hyperresonance on percussion, which is described as low-pitched and booming. Think of the big bass drum in a marching band or a timpani in an orchestra. The large size of the drum gives it the bum 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 sound. If you percuss and you only hear a dull thud, this means that there is no air underneath where you are percussing. This could mean that the lungs are full of fluid instead of air, as in pneumonia, or that that portion of the lungs has collapsed. For a nursing student practicing on a healthy partner, it is far more likely that you are accidentally percussing over bone. If you look at figure 19.16, you will notice that it's fairly easy to avoid the scapulas by starting above them and then moving down medial to them, but avoiding the ribs requires you to percuss in the intercostal spaces, which can be difficult to do. Again, being able to decide whether a sound is resonant or hyper-resonant is difficult because the sound is faint and people have a wide range of chest wall thickness, so use the principles I mentioned earlier. 1. Assess as many people as possible, and 2. After assessing a location, immediately assess the other side. After percussion, you will auscultate the posterior thorax. Before you begin, take a moment to try to eliminate any competing sounds. Turn off loud televisions, ask people not to talk while you are auscultating, and make sure nothing is bumping against the stethoscope tubing. Then instruct your patient to sit up, leaning slightly forward, and then to take deep breaths through the mouth whenever the stethoscope is touching the back, but also to stop if he or she begins to feel dizzy. In health assessment class, you are probably practicing on other health assessment students who already know what to do and they won't need these instructions, but don't forget to clearly give these instructions when you're assessing people out in the wild. Using the diaphragm of the stethoscope, auscultate the back starting at the level of the vertebral prominence and moving down to the base of the lungs. As with palpation and percussion, you will move from side to side to check for symmetry. You should listen to a full breath in and out for each location before moving on to the next one. There are 3 different types of normal breath sounds. If you were to follow the airway, over the trachea, you will first hear bronchial sounds. Once you move down to the upper sternum, where the trachea splits into the 2 bronchi, you will hear bronchovesicular sounds. Move any direction from there toward the peripheries of the lungs, and you will hear vesicular sounds made by the smallest airways and alveoli. So again, as you move from the large airways toward the alveoli, you will hear bronchial, then bronchofascicular, then vesicular sounds. As you follow this direction, the sound will gradually change in 3 ways. Bronchial sounds are 1, high-pitched, 2, loud, and 3, louder on expiration than inspiration. Vesicular sounds are the opposite. They are 1, relatively low-pitched, 2, relatively quiet, and 3, relatively louder on inspiration than expiration. Full disclaimer, if you ask an experienced nurse to describe these 3 different types of normal lung sounds, they probably wouldn't be able to tell you. This is because they learn to recognize normal lung sounds across the various lung fields without having to actively describe them. Someday this will be you as well. Until then, learning and applying this content will help train your brain to quickly learn what a normal lung sound should sound like. In terms of abnormal lung sounds can either be too quiet or too loud. First, let's talk about lung sounds which are either absent or diminished. As an example of an absent lung sound, imagine a child who inhaled a marble, and this marble traveled past the trachea, but then it got stuck in one of the bronchi. All of the smaller airways connected to this bronchi that are directly connected to the blockage will no longer have airflow, so there won't be any lung sounds coming from the area. Lung sounds will be absent. As an example of lung sounds which are present but diminished, imagine another patient who has a lung infection and the infection has caused fluid buildup in the pleural space. This is called pleural effusion. When you auscultate over this area, the fluid will act as a barrier in between your stethoscope and the airway, dampening the sound. Other lung sounds are abnormally loud. These sounds are a bit trickier to understand. Think about the example I just gave, in which fluid acts as a sound barrier, standing in between you and the lung sound. But sometimes an object placed between the sound and the listener will actually increase the volume. This happens when the object helps to transmit the sound. You may remember as a child making what's called a tin can telephone, which is when you connect two cups or cans with a piece of string. In the tin can telephone, the string is technically an object in between the listener and the sound, but instead of dampening the sound, the string actually helps to transmit the sound. Fluid buildup inside the airways can act like this string, helping to transmit sounds from the larger airways to the surface of the skin. This will cause lung sounds as well as the client's spoken voice to sound louder and clearer through the stethoscope. By the way, this is the same mechanism for increased fremitus, and you'll generally see increased fremitus and increased lung sounds presenting together. Aside from lung sounds being too loud or too quiet, you might also hear extra sounds that shouldn't be there at all. These are called adventitious sounds. I like to think of the most common sounds as falling into one of two broad categories, popping or whistling. Popping and whistling are not technical terms, they're the terms I chose because they are the most helpful for describing what is causing the sound. First, I'll talk about popping sounds. When water bubbles pop, they make a soft pop sound. Similarly, when there is fluid in the lungs, bubbles are formed and popped as air moves in and out of the airways. There are many reasons why fluid would build up in the airways, such as heart failure, lung infection, or from simply inhaling water, and they all may cause this popping sound. Collapsed alveoli will also make a pop sound at the moment when they pop open. So instead of one sound, you're really hearing many small sounds happening in rapid succession. Think of the sound of a deep fryer with all little pops and crackles. The technical term for this sound is crackles. The second category of common adventitious sounds is whistling, which is caused by air being forced through a narrow passage. Think about what you have to do to whistle with your mouth. You have to purse your lips into a narrow hole and then quickly force air through. This same thing can happen in the lungs, maybe because inflammation is causing the airways to get tighter and narrower, or because an object or fluid is partially blocking the airway. As you might guess from simply imagining what whistles generally sound like, these sounds are high-pitched and musical. The technical term for this type of sound is wheeze. So there's crackles and then there's wheeze. Your book mentions that crackles are also called râles and that wheeze are also called ronchi, but unless you happen to speak either French or Latin, these words don't actually help you to understand what the sounds actually are, which is why they are not used as often these days. Take a look at table 19.6 for more details about these sounds. Assessing the anterior chest. At this point, the textbook moves to the assessment of the anterior chest, and for the most part, you will simply be repeating what you did on the back, so this will be relatively quick. As always, start with the inspection, first looking for overall shape and symmetry. Now that you're looking at the front of the chest, you can assess the costal angle where the ribs meet the bottom of the sternum, which is normally about 90 degrees. You can also more closely assess whether the client is showing signs of increased work of breathing. People normally rely almost exclusively on the diaphragm to breathe, but a client who's working hard to breathe will also use other muscles from the neck to the abdomen to help with the effort. You may also see retractions. Try looking at your neck in the mirror and taking a few quick, deep breaths as forcefully as you can. Notice how the strong negative pressure that is created during inspiration not only sucks air into your lungs, it also sucks the skin into the body, making the muscles in the neck more prominent. This tugging of the skin is called retractions, and you may see them between the ribs and below the lowest ribs in someone who has increased work of breathing. Palpation and percussion are performed on the chest in the same way as on the back, except in slightly different locations. Palpation for symmetry is done with the thumbs at the bottom of the sternum. For fremitus palpation, percussion, and auscultation begin in the supraclavicular area, which is above the clavicle, hence the name supraclavicular, and moves side to side and down to the base of the lungs. With percussion, try to aim for those intercostal spaces so you aren't percussing over a rib. You won't have to worry about avoiding the scapulae anymore, but you may have to try to shift around breast tissue. With both percussion and auscultation, the main difference in the front is that you should see some normal asymmetry because of the heart being on the left side. The book also describes a 6-minute walk test just before the developmental competence section. To perform the test, simply place a pulse oximeter on the client and ask the person to walk as far as possible in 6 minutes. I like this test because it is easy as a healthcare professional to accidentally slip up into the bad habit of treating a disease and not the patient or assessing a body part without fully appreciating how it's attached to a living human being. It is also difficult for young people to appreciate the difficulties that older adults face when something as simple as walking for a few minutes can be a challenging task, and independence in life is something that needs to be actively maintained and even guarded rather than taken for granted. Abnormal findings. In Table 19.3, take a look at the client with a barrel chest. Recall that the ratio of the anteroposterior diameter to the transverse diameter should be 0.7 to 1. For a patient with a barrel chest, it will be about 1 to 1. This will also cause the costal angle to increase beyond 90 degrees because of the way this chest shape pushes the ribs away from the midline. Table 19.4 has two pairs of very important terms. Tachypnea is breathing too fast, and bradypnea is breathing too slow. Hyperventilation is breathing too deep, and hypoventilation is breathing too shallow. Looking at Table 19.5, I already discussed how to assess Frematus by making the client say the words 99 or blue moon, but Frematus can also be felt without the person talking at all, such as when thick secretions stuck in the airways makes pops that can not only be heard but also felt. It might also be caused by pleural friction. Recall that the whole point of the pleurae is to lubricate the lungs during breathing. If the pleurae are damaged and can't provide the lubrication, the friction may cause palpable vibrations. In Table 19.6, you'll see that the adventitious lung sounds are divided into discontinuous and continuous sounds, which I prefer to call popping and whistling sounds. Notice that the pleural friction rub is caused by the damage to the pleurae, which you just saw in Table 19.5. When you feel the vibrations with your hands is called frematus, and when you hear the vibrations through your stethoscope is called rub, but it's really the same thing. Atelectasis is when a part of the lung is collapsed, so atelectatic crackles are heard when collapsed alveoli pop open. Collapsed lung sounds pretty ominous, but a few alveoli collapse during sleep even in healthy adults, since you don't need as much oxygen when you're just lying in bed sleeping. Once awake, the person just takes a couple of big breaths and the lungs are back to 100%. The crackles heard during these first few breaths are called atelectatic crackles, and they're not concerning. Stridor is a high-pitched sound heard only on inspiration. It's very helpful to remember that stridor is caused by an upper airway obstruction, because if you ever forget what stridor sounds like, simply use your fingers to apply really slight pressure to your upper airway and try taking in a couple breaths. I'm going to try it right now. You hear that high-pitched inspiratory sound. Table 19.9 has a ton of great information about a wide range of respiratory conditions. For the sake of this episode, I'm just going to fly by a few of these, defining terms and pointing out interesting details along the way. Atelectasis means lung collapse. Atelectasis can happen for a variety of reasons, so it's really the amount of atelectasis which will determine whether it's symptomatic or not. In severe cases, because the affected side can't inflate as much as the other side, you may inspect and palpate asymmetrical chest rise. Over the affected area, because there is no airflow, you will feel less frematus, percussion will be dull, and you will hear less lung sounds. Lobar pneumonia means an infection of the lungs, which will cause fluid to leak out and fill the alveoli. This makes it impossible for the alveoli to fill with air, so you will see decreased chest expansion on the affected side and percussion will be dull. You may feel decreased frematus and hear diminished lung and voice sounds, or you may feel increased frematus and hear louder and clearer lung and voice sounds. It depends on whether the fluid is acting as a sound barrier, like a soundproof wall, or a sound conductor, like the string of a tin can telephone. As air flows through the fluid, you will hear the popping sound called crackles. You may also see general signs that may come with any infection anywhere in the body, such as chills and fever. Emphysema is a type of COPD, which stands for chronic obstructive pulmonary disease. Like many other chronic conditions, this is caused by progressive damage that is done over a long period of time. Emphysema causes high pressures inside the chest, which causes the lungs to get hyperinflated, like a balloon that's blown up to be much bigger than it should be. This expansion in chest size will mainly be achieved by an increase in the anteroposterior diameter, creating the barrel-shaped chest. Air is not a good conductor of sound, so the excessive amount of air will cause decreased fremitus and diminished lung sounds. Because the lungs are inflated so big, percussion will produce a deeper, more booming sound, the same way sound changes as you go from a small drum to a big drum. Asthma is a chronic allergic respiratory problem where the immune system has an inappropriate response to something like pollen, causing inflammation and bronchospasm, which leads to very narrow airways. During asthma attacks, the person will have to work extra hard to move air in and out through these tight airways, so you will see tachypnea and increased work of breathing. The air will also cause a whistling sound called a wheeze as air is squeezed through these narrow airways. If these symptoms are severe and prolonged, the high pressure may expand the chest into the same barrel chest with hyperresonant percussion as seen in emphysema. Pleural effusion is a buildup of fluid in the pleural space. The fluid in the pleural space will act as a barrier, causing decreased fremitus and decreased lung sounds. When percussing over the area, you will hear a sound similar to the one you would hear if you were percussing over a rib. In both cases, a barrier is stopping the vibrations from reaching the airways deeper inside. You may also feel a pleural friction fremitus and hear a pleural friction rub, as I already described. Pneumothorax is similar to pleural effusion, except that air is trapped inside the pleural space, not fluid. This air pocket will take up space in the thorax, making it harder for the lung to fill up with air and pushing everything in the thorax away from the affected area. Imagine a patient who had a traumatic injury to the right chest, which popped a hole into the pleural space, causing it to fill up with air. This right-sided pneumothorax will push both the lungs and the heart toward the left side. The right side of the chest won't be able to fill up with air in the airways, but the left will, causing unequal chest expansion. No air flow is happening over the pneumothorax, so lung sounds over that area will be decreased. But there is air there, just it's stuck inside the pleural space, so percussion will be hyperresonant. That's it for these specific conditions, but I wanted to point out a couple things before wrapping up. First, notice that emphysema and asthma are the only chronic conditions among the ones I discussed, and they are the only ones that can present with a barrel chest. This is because barrel chest is caused by remolding the thorax, and this is something that happens over years, not days. Also, in terms of subjective data, if a client has only had symptoms over the past couple of days without any personal history of respiratory issues, it probably isn't emphysema or asthma. On the other hand, if a client says that the symptoms have been progressively worsening over the past 3 years, it probably isn't something like pneumonia or pneumothorax. My final observation is that many of these clinical manifestations are common across all of these different conditions. Take, for example, tachypnea. Tachypnea is the simplest way for your lungs to compensate. If for whatever reason you happen to need more oxygen, whether it's because of pneumonia or asthma or pneumothorax, or if you climb a flight of stairs, your lungs are going to compensate by breathing faster. Tachypnea is helpful at letting you know that a problem exists or whether the problem is getting better or worse, but it's not that great at telling you what the problem is. The same is true for other signs and symptoms such as shortness of breath and increased work of breathing. And with that, I will conclude this episode on the thorax and lungs assessment. Thank you for listening.